This morning, we're in the fourth Sunday of Lent. And Lent is a season where, you know, we try to reflect on the areas of our lives that might need to experience some death, to make some space for new understandings, for new expressions to come to life. So before we jump in, I wanted to give you guys a chance to discuss this question with a neighbor. What's something that makes you come alive? All right, whether it's an activity, maybe a person, maybe a place, all right? But what's something that makes you come alive or makes you feel alive? All right, I'll give you a moment to do that. All right, what are some things that make you come alive? Throw some out. Barton Springs, yes. Makes you kind of awake too, right? Yeah. Cold water. Nature. Mm-hmm. Music. Traveling. Exercising. Family. Spouse. Goats. I'll take your word for it. They're cute. Goats are cute. Anything else? What's that? Good food. Yes. Yes, definitely. For me, one of the things that kind of makes me alive is taking road trips. And we've done a lot of them as a family recently. I love mapping out things. I love planning it. I love packing up our car. I love mainly just all the snacks. I think literally we had a tub on our last road trip. It was just all snacks. I love driving. I love driving. And, you know, my wife affectionately calls me the Roomba, the driving Roomba. So that's just what I do. I'm a driving machine. We've taken road trips to Toronto, to Calgary, to Maine, and we did the entire East Coast, California. Yeah, basically, if it takes less than 20 hours, it's not a real road trip. It's kind of how I feel. But I love that we get to stop and visit all these national parks along the way. And for me, it's just recharging. It's really life-giving for me. And as we continue to reflect on the season of Lent, right, it's about being in this space where we're in between death and life. We're in a space where we're in between lament and joy. We're in between a space of suffering and hope. And it's a season, right, of tension between these things. This is how one Franciscan writer puts it. He says, there are two moments that matter. One is when you know that your one and only life is absolutely valuable and alive. The other is when you know your life, as presently lived, is entirely pointless and empty. Lent is about both. The first such moment gives you energy and joy by connecting you with your ultimate source. And the second gives you limits and boundaries and a proper humility so you keep seeking the source and not just your small self. And so Lent is a season where we're invited to let go of some of those life-limiting practices and hopefully adopt more life-giving rhythms. And that's why Jesus came to earth, to walk the earth, to come and show us how our choices and our tendencies were hurting ourselves and hurting others. And he was inviting us to live in a new way. This is what he said. He said, I came that you may have life and have it abundantly. To have life to the full, to be made alive and to live the way God intended. And so this morning, the text we'll be looking at invites us to consider some life-giving rhythms that might help us in this journey of being made alive. So we'll be looking at Ephesians 2, verses 1 to 10 this morning. And is our custom, go ahead and read that aloud with the neighbor. The text will be on the screen. All right, so let's start in verse 1. So it says, you were dead through the trespasses and sins in which you once lived, following the course of this world, following the ruler of the power of the air, the spirit that is now at work among those who are disobedient. All of us once lived among them in the passions of our flesh, following the desires of flesh and senses, and we were by nature children of wrath like everyone else. So Paul's writing this letter to a multicultural church community in Ephesus. And, you know, the people there was a wide range of different religious and cultural backgrounds which they came from. And so he's reflecting on how easily everyone seems to conform to the world's formula of what it means to live. And what that entails is following desires of power, of status, of wealth, of self-gratification. And it's not until we've exhausted ourselves, until we've kind of burned ourselves out, that we realize that the world's formula, that these desires are actually very life-limiting. And so the first thing we're invited to consider is leaving behind those life-limiting patterns that the world encourages us to follow. Just allowing them to die, and then having the space then to explore some life-giving rhythms that Jesus invites us to experience. And it can be difficult and disorienting, right, to leave behind an old way of life, to change the way you've done things always. And there's a lot of uncertainty and discomfort when we move to a space that invites us to live in a new way. There's a French anthropologist by the name of Arnold van Gennep, and he developed the concept of liminal space back in the early 1900s. And he studied various cultures and societies, and he observed three universal stages when it came to transformational rituals or like rites of passage. And there were three common things across all of them. First, there was the separation from the old, you know, through some metaphorical death. Second, there was a crossing of a threshold, right, that marked the boundary between two phases. And then third, there was a return back, but with a new identity or a new status. And so that place of crossing, right, that transition between what was and what's next, that's the liminal space, right? That's, someone described it as, it's the in-between space when the old no longer works and the new is not yet clear, right? So there's a lot of uncertainty. There's a lot of mystery in that space. And many theologians have talked about how transformation can't take place without that liminal space. It's usually after we experience some form of death in our lives that moves us into that space. Maybe it's a death of a dream, or a death of a relationship, or a death of our physical capabilities, or a death of our theology. And it's that death that moves us into that space so that we can begin to discover what's next. And although it's uncomfortable and disorienting, that's where our growth and transformation happens if we're willing to enter and stay engaged in that space. There's a French comedian by the name of Gad Elmaleh, and he was one of the first to bring stand-up comedy to France about almost 20 years ago. And so, you know, he's become a really successful comedian now, and he's known as the French Jerry Seinfeld. But recently he said he no longer feels alive when he performs in France, because it's come to the point where he can literally say anything and people will laugh, right? And it's just, there's not much challenge. And he wants to continue to hone and grow his craft. And so he decided to leave behind his old life of celebrity, of guaranteed success in France, to try and become a stand-up comedian in America, where he had to learn an entirely new language, where he had to also learn about the cultural expressions, the cultural, you know, experiences, the cultural references. And here's an audio clip of Jerry Seinfeld, the real Jerry Seinfeld, reflecting on this this new transition that he's going through.
This whole adventure, Gad made a documentary for French TV about moving to the States. In one scene, the French Jerry Seinfeld is sitting at a restaurant with one of the few people who understands exactly how difficult it'll be to make it in America. The American Jerry Seinfeld. They're friends.
And let me tell you, let me explain this to you. This comedian, the stand-up comedian, was invented in America.
Yeah.
It was invented in America.
So you're surprised that I came to America to do this?
I get what you're doing. It's like, I want to go build a car, but I want to build it in Germany.
Okay.
And people say, really? In Germany? Then I'm going to go to Italy and I'm going to open up a pasta factory. And then I'm going to go to France. I want to make wine.
Okay.
All right?
Okay.
And then I'm going to England and I'm going to write some plays.
Okay.
Right? And then I'm going to go to America and I'm going to do stand-up comedy.
Yeah, so.
Those people are used to the best.
Okay.
You with me?
Yeah, I'm with you.
So if it was me, honestly, if it was me and I had what you had in France, I would
just... You
would
say.
I'm good. But I admire your ambition. I admire.
This is I like to hear that.
I admire. Yes. You have to be comfortable that it's going to hurt.
Right? It's going to hurt. And Seinfeld is telling Gad that, you know, being in this in-between space, you know, it's going to be extremely painful and awkward. There's going to be a lot of unknown. And Gad knew that's what he was getting into. And he knew that if he wanted to transition into this completely new environment, that he was going to have to go and give some very painful sets on stage. And that he was going to have to embrace bombing every night just so that he could learn new skills and new rhythms. And even though the struggle was very real for him, it was very real, he chose to stay in that liminal space in order to move and begin to move to become a new kind of comedian. On the flip side, though, you know, there's one encounter that Jesus had with this young government official. And he was, you know, he had power, he had influence, extremely wealthy. And, you know, maybe he was beginning to experience the limitations of his current lifestyle. And so he asked Jesus a question. He said, you know, what do I need to do to actually have a full life? What do I need to do to be fully alive? And Jesus responded and said, well, you know, you need to follow the scriptures, which he did. And you need to give everything you have away to the homeless. And, you know, as he's processing all that uncertainty and that discomfort of what this new way of living Jesus is inviting him to, that's his opportunity to step into that liminal space. And yet he couldn't do it. And he walked away instead. And so for us then, you know, what are some life-limiting patterns that we need to leave behind in order to make space to pursue some life-giving rhythms? And as we try to practice that this week, you know, maybe that might move us into a liminal space where we feel a lot of discomfort and uncertainty. For me, I gave up avoidance for Lent just so it would help me be more present and more fully engaged with people, whether at home or at work or just, you know, wherever I was, you know. So right now I'm fully present with you, just full disclosure. Because it's easy for me to avoid and to withdraw, especially when it comes to conflict. And so, you know, it takes effort and it creates discomfort when it requires me to be fully present, to fully engage. But as I've been intentional about being present the last few weeks, you know, it's actually been a really life-giving experience for myself and for those around me. And so Paul starts out this text by saying, you were dead through the trespasses and sins in which you once lived, following the course of this world. And then we continue in verse 4. But God, who is rich in mercy, out of the great love with which he loved us, even when we were dead through our trespasses, made us alive together with Christ, so that in the ages to come he might show the immeasurable riches of his grace in kindness toward us in Christ Jesus. And so Paul here, you know, he gives a pretty clear contrast between who we are when we live out of our human tendencies and who God is. Right? So right before this, you know, he describes us as children of wrath. So we're the ones that actually live out of that space of judgment and violence. Right? We're the ones who are immature in how we respond to the other when we marginalize them or when we scapegoat them. And what ends up happening is that we end up projecting our wrath onto God. And we begin to imagine that God now is the one that somehow is shaking his fist at us, that he's waiting just for the slightest thing so that he can send and rain down fire on us. And it's our own life-limiting perspective that feeds into our lens of how we see God. And Paul is saying, no, no, no. You know, God is rich in mercy. And so the second thing we're invited to consider is to receive God's unexpected mercy instead of holding on to our life-limiting perspectives of God. Right? It's God's mercy, not wrath, that was the motivation to send Jesus to earth. For God so loved the world that he sent his son. And so God's mercy took the form of Jesus, and so now he's living, and he's trying to articulate and transcend and transform our natural tendency to judge and to blame and to scapegoat. And I think what's so challenging about mercy is that we exist in a culture where shame, guilt, fear, those things shape a lot of our personal interactions. And I think we live in a culture that rewards those who are successful and accomplished, and then it punishes those who are weak or imperfect. You know, for me, growing up in Chinese culture, shame and guilt were very powerful tools to keep us in line. If you had a report card filled with A's, it didn't matter if there was one B on it. You know, if you got a 98 on something, where are the other 2 points? And that became so ingrained in me that it began to translate into how I perceived God. That somehow he was ready to judge and shame me if I didn't meet a certain standard. And I think a lot of us grew up with that understanding of God. That his mercy was, you know, kind of rare. It was limited. Right? It only showed up on special occasions, you know, when all the stars aligned. And so it was easier to think of God as being rich in judgment of us, of others. But Paul is challenging us and telling us that God is actually rich in mercy. Right? It's the unexpected richness of God's mercy that's life-giving. A little while ago, the New York Times podcasted a follow-up story to an incident that happened at a mosque in Fort Smith, Arkansas. There was a 21-year-old named Abraham, and he was part of a crew that was caught on video vandalizing the local mosque. And they were spray painting swastikas and derogatory comments all over the walls and windows. And this happened during the most recent election year. And so it was in the backdrop of all this Islamophobia and anti-immigrant tension. And yet, when they discussed it as a community, they decided, you know, one of the Muslim leaders from that mosque reached out to Abraham and told him that they didn't want him to have a felony charge on him, because they knew if he had a felony charge, that would be a permanent stain on his record for the rest of his life. And so they actually went to court to advocate on his behalf to drop the felony charge. They told him they didn't want it anymore. But unfortunately, it didn't work, and he was still convicted. And then more recently, he still had to pay a few thousand dollars in legal fines because of this conviction. But now, because he's a convicted felon, right, his opportunities to get a job are extremely limited. And if he can't pay the fine, then they were going to throw him back in jail for another 6 years. And so the mosque found out again, and they reached out. And they decided to use a couple thousand dollars of what they had set aside for the renovations of the mosque, and they gave it to him to pay off the remainder of his fine. And when Abraham listened to the audio recording of the Muslim leader explaining what the money was for and how they didn't want him to go back to prison, he was so overwhelmed. Like, he couldn't even articulate, you know, how the gratitude that he was experiencing. And for him, this was literally a life-giving experience that came from an unexpected display of mercy and kindness. You know, Jesus modeled this as well. You know, when there was one time when the religious leaders brought a woman who they caught having an affair, and so they were going to try to follow the law, and they were going to stone her to death, which seems a bit much. And, you know, in this moment of judgment and shame, you know, Jesus responds, and he's like, all right, great, let's do this. Right? So whoever has never committed a sin, you know, they should be the first one to throw a stone at this woman. And one by one, they drop their stones and all of them leave. And Jesus, right, reassures her that he's not here to condemn. He's not here to judge, but he's here to extend mercy. And I was thinking about this, and I was thinking maybe another appropriate question that Jesus could have asked the crowd. And I'm not saying that I can come up with better questions than Jesus. I'm just saying, if he was looking for my opinion, this would be an additional question he could have asked. But he could have asked, whoever has been shown mercy before, that person should be the first one to show this woman mercy. Right? It's the same idea. It's the same goal. It's in line with what Jesus taught, that we should be merciful because God has shown us mercy. And so for us, maybe something we can practice this week is to simply contemplate and meditate on how we've received mercy. You know, meditate on the unexpected ways that we've received mercy from God. Meditate on how people in our lives have shown us mercy. Maybe our friends who have been extremely patient with us, or family members that we've hurt. And as we reflect on how we've received mercy, you know, maybe we can grow in our own richness of mercy towards others. And so Paul says, but God, who is rich in mercy, out of the great love with which he loved us, even when we were dead through our trespasses, made us alive together with Christ. And then we close in verse 8. For by grace you've been saved through faith, and this is not your own doing, it's the gift of God, not the results of works, so that no one may boast. For we are what God has made us, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand to be our way of life. And so here Paul is reminding us, like, there's nothing we can do to earn God's love. Like, nothing. It's not our ability to live a moral life, or to nail down the right theology, or to be diligent in our spiritual practices. Like, all those things are definitely meaningful and helpful, but they don't determine whether or not God loves us any more or less. You know, God's love and mercy has been gifted to us without our need to perform for it. And in verse 10, what it literally says in Greek there is that we are God's poema, which is where we get the word poem. Paul's saying that we are God's poem. So in other words, God is the one who has performed an artistic expression in creating us. And so Paul is trying to shift our understanding from us being the performer to us being God's performance. So instead of us being a performer trying to so hard to earn love and worth, we're invited to just simply be God's performance. There's nothing we need to do. There's nothing that we can earn. And so the last thing we're invited to consider is to rest in being God's performance instead of thinking we need to perform to earn God's love and worth. And I think a lot of us, you know, myself included, have spent much of our lives identifying more with being a performer. Right, we've attempted to put on the right costume, say the right lines, do the right dance, all in an attempt to give ourselves credit for earning what we think we deserve. And so we spend a lot of energy and resources trying to become someone that we're not. And then we burn ourselves out trying to create our own worth. And then we end up taking that same approach to how we interact and relate with God. And so what would it mean for us then to identify more with being God's performance? Now, I think that would involve looking inward to discover the beauty, the worth that God's already given us. Right? This is what the poet says in Psalm 139. He says, "Oh yes, you shaped me first inside and then out. You formed me in my mother's womb. I thank you, high God, you're breathtaking. Body and soul, I am marvelously made. I worship in adoration. What a creation. You know me inside and out, and you know every bone in my body. You know exactly how I was made, bit by bit, how I was sculpted from nothing into something. Like an open book, you watched me grow from conception to birth. All the stages of my life were spread out for you. The days of my life all prepared before I'd even lived one day." And he's describing this poetic art that God created in each of us. And he reflects on the beauty and the intricacy of our bodies, of our being, and how much thought went into this creation. And there's an acknowledgement of how much God has done in this performance and how little we've been a part of it. It kind of reminds me of what it was like to raise our kids when they were newborns. And I know some of you are right there in the midst of it. That was a long time ago. And they were our little creations, right? That's how it works. And we did everything for them. Right? We changed them, cleaned them, fed them, you know, held them. There was absolutely nothing that they were doing to contribute to our family. Nothing. And yet that didn't impact my ability to love them more or less. You know, I think one of my favorite parts of the day was watching them sleep, because that meant we could sleep. But I remember so many times when I would just stare at their little face, stare at their little hands, at their little feet, and they would just be resting, right? Without worrying about their worth, without having to worry about how they would earn my love, because they were loved and they already had worth. And for us, it almost seems counterintuitive that we need to rest in order to fully understand how much God really loves us. But that's the invitation we've been given. That there's no need for us to perform to earn love and worth. And so, Vox, my hope for the remainder of this Lenten season is that we would be willing to enter and stay in those spaces that might be uncomfortable, that we would show mercy the same way God has shown us mercy, and that we would rest knowing that we don't have to perform in order to earn God's love. And so let me close with this poem by David White. "No one but me by the fire, my hands burning red in the palms, while the night wind carries everything away outside. All this petty worry, while the great cloak of the sky grows dark and intense round every living thing. What is precious inside us does not care to be known by the mind in ways that diminish its presence. What we strive for in perfection is not what turns us into the lit angel we desire. What disturbs and then nourishes has everything we need. What we hate in ourselves is what we cannot know in ourselves. But what is true to the pattern does not need to be explained. Inside everyone is a great shout of joy waiting to be born. Even with the summer so far off, I feel it grown in me now and ready to arrive in the world. All those years, listening to those who had nothing to say. All those years, forgetting how everything has its own voice to make itself heard. All those years, forgetting how easily you can belong to everything simply by listening. And the slow difficulty of remembering how everything is born from an opposite and miraculous otherness. Silence and winter has led me to that otherness. So let this winter of listening be enough for the new life I must call my own. And so we ask all this in the name of God, our Creator, the unexpected mercy of the Son, and the empathy of the Spirit. Amen.